is enforced. And thereafter, they show signs that they will make good on the land, and they will, once they develop the land to a certain degree, then a grant is issued.
Mm-hmm. Does that test work?
It does.
Some people abandon the land.
Some people abandon the land.
And what do you do then?
Then we realignate it.
What if they sort of neglect the land but work on it a bit and, you know, hardly put in any effort? If they put up a shack but don't cultivate it?
Now there is, that again is a condition. But we don't impose, we are not very strict about it. Because in practice it is not possible. It again gets down to the same problem now. For a breach of any one of these conditions, if we cancel the lot, we will have to eject him. Ejectment means they will be deprived of one main thing, a place to live in.
Yes, but ejection was meant to be a deterrent, and if you don't use it, in some cases it will have a wider effect and everyone will begin breaking the law. Breaking the conditions.
In reality, I think, even if you take statistics, I don't know how correct those statistics are, but you will observe that the number of cancellations and evictions for breach of any other condition other than non-residence are very few. That is because if a man is resident on the land, even if he does not maintain his house and other buildings in good condition, even if he does not do the cultivation properly or breaks any one of the conditions, one would be reluctant to cancel the land and evict him because he will be deprived of a place to stay. So you'll find generally all cases of cancellations are for, majority of the cases of cancellation are for non-residents.
How far has the political factor influenced this? And the question of petitions and then politicians troubling you and making your life misery if you evict a person or if you try to impose the condition?
Quite a number of instances as much as in other cases. Now, I had a clear case a few days ago. There was an allotment. This was given to A.
Yes.
A's wife was not living. A had only one stepson. And he was living on the allotment with the stepson. The stepson was employed as a mechanic. So he had a certain amount of income. So he invested his income also on improvements to the house. He obtained that. Of course, the father obtained the assistance for the house, but the son put in some extra money, because that is only a subsidy for house construction and not the total cost of the house. So that the stepson put in a certain amount of his money, improved, and they were living. And the stepson got married. He got two children also. In the meantime, the old man fell out with the daughter-in-law.
Oh.
And then immediately the stepson. So he was finding things difficult. Then he took his belongings and left the house and went to the village, and he was supposed to be running a boutique with another person, but anyway, he was staying in that boutique. Then representations were made by the people. Of course, the people seemed to be against the old man. Because I understand he drinks and plays hell. Then representations were also made by the stepson, who was incidentally the nominated successor for the land, saying that his father has left the allotment and requesting that the allotment be alienated. At the inquiry, the old man accepted the fact that he just couldn't live on the land. Now, even if I give him time to get on the land, well, he could not have gone and lived with the son. So I had no alternative but to cancel the land, because he admits that he is not in residence and he cannot go into residence. Then, of course, he was aggrieved. He had the billable time was available, but then he went to an MP and the MP rang me up and I said that I had done a very unfair thing. So I told him.
But he had agreed at that time.
Yes, he agreed he couldn't live. He agreed that he was not in residence. Also, he stated that he could not live. So there was one or two things for me, either to eject the son and put him in. But was that more satisfactory? The question. Here was, the son was resident on the land, he had spent money on the construction of the house, then he was married and having three children. This man was a single man, and he has a place to stay. So apart from the law, I mean, the fairer thing would be to give the allotment to the son, stepson.
Yes. Was there political interference even when you chose people at land cultivation?
Yeah.
Did they try to know? And does that influence the choice of, does it influence the choice of officers? Haven't they to take this into consideration sometimes?
I believe it does. But of course, one who is practically minded and who is able, tactful enough to handle a situation, I mean, when on instances like that, You see, they can fully get over the problem.
Mm-hmm. What about ministerial interference? Interference from the top?
No, generally there is no interference from the top. Mm-hmm. The only interference is from the local MP.
Mm-hmm.
But then it is not always so. It all depends on the individual. There are so many instances. Mm-hmm. That MP says, well, right, so and so is what is the land strategy. He will do the same thing. That is if the MP is very good with the upper concern and he has confidence.
Mm-hmm.
But then there again, it's a question of human rights. It all depends on the individual.
Yes, it's
yes.
I heard the case of sometimes at ministerial level, sometimes officer has made a particular decision and it affects two parties. And one party takes his case to the ministry, or so the MP to the ministry, say it's a government MP.
Mm-hmm.
And also there are two conflicting parties. Then another, the second party also did it at a different time. And the ministry sends answers favoring both parties.
There are instances like that, and there are cases which go on for innumerable length of time more than that.
Don't the ministry realize that they are playing, giving contradictory opinions?
Well, I suppose for one thing, because they go independently, they are too busy to investigate the thing and coin it. Or it may also so happen that they do not want to dissatisfy either party.
And someone told me that one instance, someone got these two contradictory orders, so he put them together and put it in one case and send them and they decide. And he never got the file back.
It's not impossible.
But what about the other aim of improved cultivation, improved husbandry?
Now, that of course we try to sort of, but mainly by means of propaganda, mm-hmm. try to get them to use improved methods of cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
For that purpose, of course, apart from our department, the Department of Agriculture also joined the field. But then one thing I have observed is it's very, very difficult for our cultivators to get them to change the traditional system. They take to a new idea very, very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, their knowledge of agriculture is absolutely poor, except for the traditional systems, they know nothing. That is because in our country, the most illiterate man takes to agriculture, which should not be so. In fact, the farmer should only go on do experimenting and find out better methods and see to himself. But such farmers, I suppose, we don't even have 1% of them.
Yes. From your training in agriculture, I mean, did you feel that the course you had in Perdani and other places would have helped you to apply improved methods to paddy cultivation?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
In my work, it comes in handy every day.
I think in that case it would be a good feature for government to make it a point to give preference to agricultural graduates when they choose DNOs.
Now, of course, that question does not rise because there is no separate service as DNO.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the administrative service.
No, but formally?
Yes, formally, I suppose. I do not
know. I doubt if they did it.
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
What
about the Paddy Lands Bill of 1958? Did it influence this working of the land development ordinance? Did it bear on that?
No. The Pedlands Act
does
not apply to the NDO lands.
Oh.
No, the entire act. But then certain sections of it with regard to cultivation, formation of cultivation committees, etc.
Yes.
Do apply.
Uh-huh. How does it apply?
Very frankly, the Pedlands Act I have forgotten.
It's not applied.
Yes. So actually I don't rule it, it's the ACS, it is the ACS who does it. We are just trying to organize cultivation meetings at Winnipeg. So in all probability once we get going I'll become cognizant of the Act and the amendments.
Mm-hmm. But someone told me that it has never been implemented really, for the Pedlands
Act. I suppose as a whole.
You have any idea why this is so? Why it has never been implemented?
No, I couldn't tell you often because I'm not quite common.
Mm-hmm. What about this general question of colonization schemes? I mean, what do you think of the idea of colonization schemes? Has it been in the national interest?
My gosh, I think it definitely has.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from the fact that it provides a means of livelihood,
mm-hmm.
and it has increased the country's agricultural production, there have been so many other benefits, such as solving the housing problem,
mm-hmm.
then provision of educational, health and other facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whenever a colonization scheme is opened up, you see, in addition to they are taking over the land, hospitals are constructed, schools are constructed. So, along with the housing and cultivation facilities, they also get the other things.
But with regard to agricultural production of land, speaking from ignorance, hasn't the cost of putting these colonization schemes up, sort of diminished the value of the produce there? You know, in a sense, it hasn't been paid.
Well, to start with, the being national schemes and handled by government, they are. The economics of it has not been really worked out, mm-hmm. and the aim is not profit.
Agreed, but I mean, it's pointless increase in agricultural production at a tremendous and prohibitive cost, you know, when you look at it economically too.
Oh yes, but I haven't actually had the occasion to sort of do a comparative study of how costly similar schemes would be in other places.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe it's not that vast.
In other countries?
No. Here, I mean, now generally, any venture, they say, your investment should be recovered over a period of 10 years or so.
Yes, that's right.
So I believe even on that basis, if some figures are obtained and an analysis made, I mean, the cost would not have been prohibitive.
Oh, it wouldn't have been. No, because someone, this is entirely unchecked,
yes.
but someone said that the cost of maintaining colonization, putting up colonization schemes, has been totted up, and someone has said that if we put employ that amount in industry, we could have got the same benefits in housing and production and
that is a very vague thing. Now say for instance industry. Now industry would depend on what amount of raw materials that we have. Now what is the raw material that we have?
And market.
Yes, and market. Now say for instance, now one of the serious things is how they have attempted to make blades in this country. Now how inferior that blade, and isn't it very much cheaper for us to get that thing down instead of wasting so much money on in making that blade from outside? I mean, there are industries which a country can open, and there are things which they shouldn't attempt to.
And after all, we have one such land, which we are using.
Yes, and all our industries, I think, should be closely connected to our main thing, that's agricultural production.
Mm-hmm.
Things which are prohibitive, I do not think we should attempt. Now, say for instance, generally, I believe the figure for provision of irrigation facilities to a colony allotment, that is including the cost of headwell and the general system, is somewhere around 3,000 rupees. Then the construction of the house, construction of general buildings such as hospitals, maternity homes, schools, etc., taking all that into consideration, the cost of an allotment would be about 12,000 rupees. Now, if you have 3 acres of paddy, that 3 acres during the initial years definitely would give about 300 bushels. That's 60 bushels during maha and say 40 bushels during yala. And that is without fertilizer. So 300 bushels on the guaranteed price scheme would be 3,600 rupees. So that 12,000 investment is covered in going.
Mm-hmm. You have to reduce it because of the guaranteed price.
Yes. So even if you put it down at 8 rupees,
yes.
it's still 2,400 rupees. And
in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So I think taking into consideration the problems of the country, that's lack of housing, lack of employment and various things, it is not an unwise thing to spend on colonization. Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. Some governments I know of embarked on these projects with the idea, partly at least for political purposes, in the sense that they thought they'd get votes from these people too. But hasn't it been a fact that generally the colonies have voted against whichever government was in power? Or is that so?
I find it difficult to say so without any certainty, because you do not know how the trend of their voting.
Yes.
Secret ballot then, but then.
But there is this tendency to complain and say that government hasn't given this and therefore we are against government.
Somehow or other, I do not know why, but the colony is a disgruntled one. That is why they probably always is against any government.
This is this question of this top-down mentality, you know, have getting everything from the top
and the top
and not doing it themselves.
Now you'd be surprised to hear. Well, I had a petition from a colonist, from some colonists, saying that a cat had fallen into the well and requesting the government to remove the cat. And that
yes, I see. Have you got any other examples?
Well, now there was in Minipay scheme.
Yes.
There was a strong blowing a few weeks ago. And a few, some houses have been damaged, the tiles have got broke, which they came the petition, asking government to do them all. Surely they are in a position to replace a few tiles.
And they are quite competent with their hands to their hands.
And that's the thing that could easily be done. Somehow they have got the feeling that government should step in and do everything for them.
In the colonial system schemes itself, with all these officers and the STLOs and, you know, the irrigation men and all, do these, Brahmin services, don't these new set of officials have a lot of scope to terrorize and therefore to extract bribes and so on and so forth?
They are all at the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
That is why now, for instance, if that would entirely depend on the supervision also you exercise on these schemes.
Mm-hmm.
If you freely, frequently visit the schemes, meet the people directly, then you can eliminate to quite a degree. In spite of that, of course, things can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have at least you have the chance of getting certain information. And well, even if 100 cases may bypass you, at least there are bound to be one that will count.
And are they ready to bring complaints against officers, specific cases?
Mm-hmm.
No, because there is always this danger of being terrorized again. If the officer and learn he has complained against me, he can...
Yes, there are a set of people who believe us, but I think now generally the people are not so reluctant to bring complaints against me.
And that's a good feature.
Not if you, for instance, wherever I have been, I made it a point at least to meet the people once a month at a division basis, where they can directly bring all their complaints to me.
How is the... You are like a liaison being with the irrigation and survey people. Have you been working close?
We have to.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly irrigation.
Doesn't it sometimes delay matters, this difficulties of liaison?
No, it does now. We overcome it now. There again, it would depend on what you do and what you do. Now, everywhere I have been, I meet these irrigation people regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the case of Minipay scheme, we meet at least once in 2 months, where the irrigation people, the colonization officers and others all come. And then we review the various difficulties, irrigation difficulties that we have and the progress made.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very useful, I should think. And you haven't generally found any interdepartmental friction?
No, I personally have never had the... Okay, sir. That entirely depends on your dealing with
and the human factor again.
And human factor again. It entirely depends. Now, say for instance, generally the direction of this, in other words, whether it is irrigation difficulties or any other matter, it is generally the kachari who sort of, although they don't directly supervise the working of those departments, it's the kachari that coordinates the thing. So, it entirely depends on the DLO officer who is handling that, the AG or who is handling that scheme. It entirely depends on the relations with the office concerned.
Now, you were mentioning the enormous volume of work. Do you feel that the DLO districts are a bit too large for you to cover? The districts you are supposed to supervise, are they too large?
At the moment, they are.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, radical change has to be made in the total system of administration.
Is there too much paperwork?
Far too much paperwork.
Can it be reduced?
It can be reduced.
Mm-hmm.
That's why proper reorganization must be done in English.
Throughout,
it is absolutely necessary. Piecemeal adjustments here and there will never work properly. In fact, it would tend to complicate matters further. A complete reorganization is absolutely necessary.
And also, you think there has been too much of a tendency towards this ceremonial functionings and extracurricular activities?
Yes, that is so. But as far as the working itself, getting out of the same problem, as far as the working itself is concerned, I think this is a thing that would apply not only to our department, to land commissioners, but many other departments in the island. There are far too much of control from Kalamandir.
More decentralization.
Much more decentralization has to be done, and I think, in fact, that amount of control is not at all justified also, because the officers in the districts, officers who are handling these schemes and other things, I mean, as far as our department is concerned, I think they are fully competent to handle more responsibility.
Mm-hmm. What sort of influence has the new education and the increase in white-collar mentality had on agricultural activities and colonies?
Well, I believe as much as it affects in normal village areas, even within colonization schemes, the general tendency is for these people to seek white-collar jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think their intention is at all, the younger generation, as it is now, to get back to the land.
So in that case, our quantity of, our percentage quantity of agriculture is yearly decreasing.
I think at the present it definitely is, and not only that, the quality itself will decrease. In other words, it will be the child who cannot take to anything else who would take to agriculture. In which the chap who can't pass the best time. The numbers appear to be decreasing, and the quality also seems to be decreasing.
Have you opened any new colonization schemes recently? Anywhere? Or is it a question of administrating old ones?
In the district we don't have any. But the military scheme eliminations are going on still.
Oh, I see. If I could. Oh, then what happened to the accelerated alienation under Bandhan Act? After 56, there was a special tendency to accelerate.
What they tried out is, according to the old system, the land was cleared departmentally, houses were built,
yes,
general buildings were put up, and the people were moved into the scheme. Now, the accelerated scheme that you are referring to is really the people are put on the land, people are put in possession of jungle. They were expected to do the filling. And subsequently, the departments went and put up the buildings, general buildings and cottages. I think either way, it doesn't make any difference. Only thing is, we are making the people to suffer more, because I feel that under those advanced alienations, the thing has been getting more delayed than before.
Yes, I heard lots of criticism on this. People said that this giving them jungle land to clear, they invariably were never able to clear it.
See, the thing is, once these colonies move onto the land, at least within a year or two, they must get the irrigation facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Without that, they find it very difficult, because in the dry zone, you clear the land. The first season, being virgin jungle, there's a good crop of whatever it may be, vegetables or whatever crop you put. But about the second or the third season, the fertility drops to that degree where they feel that it's not economic to cultivate, do any cultivation without irrigation.
So
from there onwards, they have to suffer.
So this, wasn't this advanced alienation, the impression I got, facts on this, was that it was done for political purposes, because there was such demand for land that they quickly...
Well, the intention was to definitely accelerate
mm-hmm.
the rate of land alienation, but I don't think they have achieved very much.
What about agricultural policy in general? I mean, looking at it from you, both from the DLO's point of view and your knowledge of agriculture, what would you say could be done to improve government agricultural policy? Any past shortcomings in the past?
Very frankly, that's of course a very big question.
Yes.
Very frankly, any department, the government may try to increase our food production, they may use all the means possible. But my frank opinion is, unless you do away with the rice subsidy, you can't effectively implement any food production program in the country.
Why? Does it have conduce to bad production, bad in uneconomic production?
Now food production is not only production of rice.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have got into this very unfortunate situation of depending so much on rice.
Yes.
And along with food production also was our food habit.
Yes, I see.
Really? Now we are supposed to be producing somewhere about 60% of our rice. So theoretically, every family in the country could have one meal of rice a day, which is more than adequate, because this is a country, there are so much of other foodstuffs.
Oh,
any shortage, you can grow it in 3 months, within one season. So that, in other words, if you completely withdraw rice imports, nobody in this country is going to die.
Yes,
that is actually the fact of the matter. But for political reasons, no political party will dare to do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, they won't even knock the rice up there. Apart from stopping imports.
Apart from the economic question of government saving money, don't you think that the rice subsidy tends to prop up the rice industry and give it a support which should be able to do without?
Well, there again, the guaranteed price
mm-hmm.
certainly has had an effect. But there again, a large share of the money goes to the wrong hands.
How?
It does not reach the cultivator.
Middleman. Isn't there a system of selling Russian cars? Don't the visitors sell some of the Russian cars? Don't the cultivators?
But they do. That is how all the malpractice takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Now see, you would have read enough of this even in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
It goes in a hell of a ring. It's a real ring. Now, the producer, he is entitled to surrender a certain quantity of paddy to the GPS.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in theory, you surrender half the amount. But onto the books, it's taken as a full surrender. Now, if 100 bushels are taken on at the stores,
mm-hmm.
then it's sent to the miller. The miller should give a certain percentage of milled rice for that quantity.
Mm-hmm.
So on paper, the miller gives, say, if it is 400 bushels of paddy, 50 bushels of rice, then in reality, the quantity of paddy that leaves the store is much less. So therefore, the quantity of rice that the miller can give is much less.
Mm-hmm.
The balance is made up of that rice that is bought up by various people
mm-hmm.
from people who do not use the rice.
Mm-hmm.
That is one other.
And in fact, how can we change the people's habits from rice to vegetables and other, and even new crops? Like, I know
it will be so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, say for instance, take the question of potatoes. Now, last year we have imported somewhere potatoes to the tune of about 25 million rupees. Now, see the number of substitutes you get in this country for potatoes. Breadfruit,
mm-hmm.
desiala, kiriala, manioc, sweet potatoes,
mm-hmm.
and a number of other kinds of yams. So, apart from other reasons, there is such a wide variety of them. In fact, I am so surprised why on earth we should even get down a single potato into the country.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the other hand, we import so much of potatoes, all the breadfruit and these other yams just rot in the villages, they have no market. So both ways we lose. That is why I say, any amount of propaganda and all this cry about food production, you will achieve nothing as long as there is no market for your produce.
Well, of course, a lot of trouble also stems, I suppose, from various political considerations.
Very unfortunate. Our food problem is so closely tied with politics, we just can't do a thing about it. I mean, nobody would dare do it. I only hope somebody would be bold enough to break through the ice. They definitely would have achieved something for many generations to come. Now, take the food subsidy. At this rate, we will arrive at position where our entire earning will have to spend on food subsidy.
If I could just, as a sort of final sphere, if I could jump to question of the Kandy district and things like chain of cultivation. Is chain of cultivation found at all in this district?
No, it's very limited amount of chain of cultivation. That's in Udumba, mini area.
That's dry zone and dry
yes,
zone?
That's really dry zone.
That's dry zone. Then how was it that in the 19th century the chain of cultivation is said to have been played so important a part in the economy of the Kandyan peasants?
Yes, they of course at that time the population was much lesser.
Yes.
And they didn't do intensive forms of cultivation.
So you think intensive forms of cultivation have fulfilled the role that chain of crops have formerly fulfilled?
Oh, certainly they would. In fact, the Tibetan tradition is much better than the ancient Vedantism. Very wasteful form of cultivation.
No, but now, for instance, the dry zone where there is no irrigation, there is no alternative, is there, to change?
But still, there is now. It is not a custom in this country to irrigate highlands.
Yes.
It's only problem in Jaffna. Now in the rice zone there is no difficulty of finding ways and means of irrigating highland for production of substitute good crops.
There is no difficulty in
no difficulty. The general feeling in the people is irrigation would mean paddy cultivation and nothing more. But that should not be really so. Now, say for instance, even the small tanks, village tanks, now if you can do 10 acres of paddy, well, you can do 50 acres of vegetables under that with the same amount of water.
Mm-hmm.
And intensive cultivation could be done. Now, vegetable or chili or any other crop for that matter, intensive cultivation and irrigation would be much more profitable than chili cultivation. Or even paddy.
Yes, but that lot. But where there is no irrigation, water available, readily available?
There again, also, for instance, one thing that has not been investigated properly is underground water. Well,
no, but that's the point. Dry zone doesn't have much of it, I think. Generally,
not all over, but I'm certain there will be so many pockets, places where they can find water close to the surface.
I thought Abhiratnan and Christopher Parnell book and all his findings have been that rotational dry land farming on non-irrigable land is not practicable in dry zone. And so far, it's not
very well. I do not think it is necessary to think of underground water, although I mention it, because sufficient surface water can always be collected. Now, construction of tanks for paddy cultivation, that's a big job because the tanks have to be very large.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of collection of surface water for vegetables will not be such a big problem because the tanks can be very small.
Mm-hmm. And geographically, isn't it all the fact, coming back to Kandy district, that even these wet highland zones, chain cultivation is not normally not always practicable because of these rains and you need a long dry period and things like that.
Yeah, but you need a long dry period only during the felling and drying period. No? So generally, even these areas have a dry period of 2 months.
That's enough?
Yeah, that's enough for felling and burying. That's enough.
No, I was from a historical point of view, I was trying to work out how important chaina cultivation was in those days, in the 19th century. It has been said that it was complementary to the paddy crops. And certainly from what the administrator said, in some areas, Sabargama and a few areas, they are dependent solely on it.
But suppose the form of chaina cultivation that was adopted in the wet zone was not the same as that of the dry zone.
Yes.
Dry zone, actually that is the proper definition of chaina cultivation of shifting form of cultivation.
Yes.
But I should think, in the wet zone, it is more this way. They had the paddy fields right at the bottom. Then they had the houses around the paddy fields.
That's right.
Then immediately around the houses, they had a few permanent plantations, coconut and medicines, yes, whatever it may be.
And
then beyond that, what they call chaina land was really dry land cultivation.
Dry land?
The highland cultivation of things like chilies and whatever it may be using, vegetables and things like that.
And also native coffee, coffee and
whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes, it invariably was a mixed cultivation. Now, what I mean is, really the permanent trees, the lime and various things were around their houses. Then the land beyond that, they cultivated with coffee and whatever, and annual crops, vegetables and things like that.
How important a role does the buffalo or the buffaloes and cattle play in the village economy in Kenya? Do they have many buffaloes? They don't, do they?
They don't have many. Of course, in the hilly areas, it's not always that you can use buffaloes for plowing.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the fields in the Kandy district, they will have to mama to the field. Then it would be an ideal thing to combine animals with cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the trend is otherwise.
And how is it that pastoral activities are never caught on with Sinhalese, and even useful food like milk, till recently, I think, was not popular.
Definitely. It is so strange that the people, that the ordinary person, is not conscious of improving his position. both in the way of living, health and various other aspects, they are content with the meat, they are as minimum. These things that I have found out, foolish, you see. They are just not bothered about improving their conditions. They are quite content in remaining in the same position. That, I suppose, accounts for this lethargy and indifference towards cultivation and infrastructure. Now, for instance, this season in particular, there has been a drought and they could not cultivate the peripheries. But there is definitely sufficient moisture. You want to plant a thing like green grass, which is so easy.
Munata.
Yeah, munata. No, it's not for that. Any kind of vegetable. You will find all the fields barren all over there. They haven't done any form of cultivation.
Do peasants in this area try to grow tea at all?
There are
a few small holdings. Many what sort of percentage?
I couldn't tell you the percentage. But it's just catching on because the tea control is now encouraging them to grow tea. And around the Nalpati area, some allotments they have taken to tea cultivation.
Have you had experience of areas with rubber cultivation?
No, I haven't.
I was wondering how far the proximity of an estate, tea or rubber, or coconut estates, you would may have experienced that.
Certain amount, yes.
Help the villagers in that it provided part-time labor. Does it help them economically?
It does. As a matter of fact, most of our allotties are existing because of the estates.
Most of these colonization people or village
expansion people in the Kandy district?
Yes.
They salary depend on work on estates.
It is a stable for the work. Are they liable to be chucked out at any moment?
Yes, at the moment, of course, they are taken in addition only to their estate permanent labor.
Yeah.
So they are all casual employees and then they don't get full-time employment.
But they prefer that too, don't they? They prefer.
In a way, they prefer that because they can have a few days off for their own other things, cultivation of their own land. That combination is ideal from their point of view. They will go and work a few days on the estate, come back and do work in the village.
So then the plantation in that case is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, definitely not a bad thing. Well, if now the government carries through the program of sending away the Indian estate workers,
and
of course it should suit them ideally because eventually they will have to take over. But even otherwise, certainly it helps them.
Just one other question with regard to DLOs. Did you feel that, I know I'm speaking about other officers, but talking over the period of this last 15 to 10 years, that many of the DLOs were just time servers and looking for other jobs or, you know, just not putting their heart and soul into the job?
No, that was not so.
No.
According to the old order, amongst the administrative jobs, next to the civil service, best job was the ASOs, National Settlement Officers, and DLOs. Because those jobs carry the highest maximum, 13-2.
So there was no one trying to...
At that time, we were recruited, there was no prospect of our getting promoted into a higher job, etc. So that in the case of those who have left, it is purely because they were not so happy with the work. Because the work has been always, everywhere, in every district, has been very heavy. And sometimes very unpleasant, particularly in the colonization schemes.
Oh, I see. Unpleasant in what way? Apart from heaviness?
Well,
political?
No, in colonization schemes, they generally find difficulty in doing whether these chaps come and trouble you or lay all the kind of complaints. Now, for instance, if you go to colonization scheme, you find 500 people coming with 500 different complaints. So you have no peace. Mm-hmm. And some of them are things that you just cannot tackle on the spot. Now, say for instance, irrigation difficulty, one of the main things in colonization schemes. You will find the same colonists coming and telling you over and over again the same difficulty. And you are not in a position to get it rectified.
No, that's very interesting. I asked this question because, I've been through university and I know that some chaps would go out there, attitude is, take it easy and also, if possible, they are looking for something which brings them into city life. And I suppose, sort of, by upbringing, they don't put their best into the job. You see, that's the impression I get. I know that some fellows are like that, especially when they go into teaching.
Yeah, that's again a human factor which is not only found in the regular service, but in any other service for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a human being, one would always like to better your position, not only financially, but also in the way of living conditions, etc. So, if, say, for instance, I feel that a university job is better, even the, at a lower salary, if the conditions are better, well, I would, as a human being, take it over.